I want to thank you for Tuesday evening, for helping, for the contributions which you, most of you, have made, and to express appreciation to you for sticking with the most difficult journey. For someone like myself, who from birth has been dealing as a mystic mariner, it seems like that's the way things are. But I realize that for many of you, it's very difficult to follow through what often appears as distant or ambiguous or perhaps even boring. And yet you have enough integrity to sense that something important is occurring, and you have enough heart energy to help out. I might just say that as far as my insight goes in the very deepest samadhi, I think that there'll be just 7 more weeks of the Tuesday evening class. So if you're interested at all, you might take them in. I think that the 7th week from this past Tuesday will do for the last time in a rehearsal sort of a way the Hermetic Wisdom Liturgy. And then after that, it'll be committed to whatever use it can be for our brethren on this struggling world to use as their communities see fit. And the liturgy itself will appear as the first of the 2 appendixes in the book Jesus in Alexandria. And I think that the material developed through the Tuesday sessions over quite some long time was necessary to the fullest scope, the fullest development of some of the work. For those who are following in a more esoteric way, I might remind you that in August of this year, Voyager 2 will encounter Neptune, and because Neptune is now the farthest planet in our solar system, we will effectively have completed a mystic journey through the entire pattern of our star system for the first time. And as Voyager 2 courses past Neptune in August, the whole era of human development will have come to a close. A childhood and an adolescence will have ended. And for those who can, who need to shoulder wider responsibility, the time has come to do so. So there'll be just 6 more weeks of the Tuesday evening, as far as I can see, and then the 7th week will be a final performance of the Hermetic Wisdom Liturgy in a rehearsal mode. Now the 6th week from that is the 4th of July, and because it's also the last formal lecture, we'll have some kind of a camaraderie. I don't know if we can get fireworks in. We'll do something. We'll have, as my San Francisco mentor used to say, we'll have some kind of human pyrotechnics and make it worth our while. So if you get interested, if you are interested, if you thought you might be interested, there are the facts, there are the situations. And we'll do what we can to round that out. Now we're on art, and you know that as part of the remaining tasks which you have before you here through the month of June, there are 2 projects yet to be brought into play. One of them is a painting, and one of them is a mask. And the 2 remaining assignments, as we have said, are meant to be evocative together. They intertwine together. The painting is the most convenient way in our culture, in our society, to achieve a personal expression in a visible, tangible way. And the mask is of a role, some role which you are able to identify in your life, your job, your position as a householder, as a mother, whatever that, as a teacher, many of you in your own right are teachers, but to distinguish that role from yourself and to make a mask which personifies that role and to bring that mask in. Now what we're going to do with those masks is a very sophisticated discovery mode. So those masks need to be brought in at least by the middle of June, so we have time to make our dramatic use of those masks, of those roles, complete. The paintings are due now. Bring them in as soon as you can, and then the mask we'll start with at the middle of June. Now the mask assignment, for those who have been slogging through this for the duration, realize that the art mask is exactly polar opposite to the ritual mask, and that the ritual mask was actually two masks which together made an interface. One mask was a mask of something in your diet, something you eat, something you take from this world and put inside of you. And this body makes a part of you from the outside in. And the other mask was that of a feeling, some strong feeling that is an expression from the inside out. And those two motions, that inner assimilation and that outer expression, those two motions together in their complementation are a unity of the dynamics of the psyche on the ritual level. It's the most primordial wholeness that man was capable of. Early man was not a Zen master in terms of nature. That's quite a different orientation. His most primordial ordering of wholeness came in his ritual comportment, in the ability to make a mask of his god and to dance as that god in ceremonies brought by dreams. And that was the first wholeness that we were capable of. And I must say this to you, we were capable of that quite some long time ago. The Australian Aborigines are probably the longest remaining primordial community, and they appeared in Australia some 60,000 years ago. And already at the beginnings of their civilization, of their culture, already at the beginnings, there are masks. So the use of masks goes back some 70, 80, 90,000 years ago at least, as ritual usage. But the art usage of masks goes back just 2,500 years. The art mask occurs, one might say, almost within living memory. And what we are doing now is we are trying to bring out of our experience, out of ourselves, tease it out, elicit it, evoke it, demand it if necessary, force it if need be, at this particular juncture, to try and make that sophisticated conscious mask. And we need this to juxtapose that most primordial sense of wholeness that came from the ritual mask, which we made last year. We made almost at this same time last year those ritual masks. Once that polarity is established, and the art mask and the ritual masks in their motions form a new complementarity, we will have a sense of self possible to us, which you may not have experienced before in your life. Some of you may have experienced it and not known what you were experiencing, but the sense that you are a mobility, your psychic energy, it has an autonomous quality which can be integrated and brought to a focus in your life, in your person. The following 3 months, starting in July, August, September here, as we round a great corner in our education, those following 3 months will be concerned with history. And there, the essential issue is, does history make the person, or does the person make history? Who is the player? And it's important for us to establish that we make history. Our freedom is the structural bedrock of what turns out to be history. This is not always the case, and it is not necessarily the case, but it's a condition that we must understand is entirely possible and, to put it in colloquial terms, entirely natural. Now, in the past, I used to have, in place of history in the program, in the development, religion. Because the next phase of development from the individual, once you acquire the sense of the person, the next phase is to acquire the sense of community. But it's difficult to understand community in religious terms for us. And so history is a more appropriate vehicle. And the religious insight will have to come along as a concomitant, as it were, to the historical realization. But in order to help you, in order to be a real companion on my part, for me to be a real guide for you in this history section, I'm going to use a play that I wrote about 6 years ago, a one-act play, which focuses and brings to the stage, brings to a stage and the stage, the necessary feeling tones and characters and ideas and possibilities and relationships that are necessary to master this history aspect of consciousness. The amplification of the individual as history. What I do, what I am, what I intend to do, what I have left undone. All of that is grist for the actual history that does occur. And because of the insight of the Buddha some 2,500 years ago, we can understand with almost scientific accuracy, if we are not free, then history as karma will jail us. And the only escape from that prison is to go back and be free. So this is a difficult sequence, but one which I must tell you is able to be experienced and mastered. I must tell you this, that I have no problem whatsoever with it myself. That you're in good hands, as much as can be. Now some of you who are still new and kind of unexperienced, don't be too despondent or sad at the stiff words. It's just, come in, John. It's just that you need to be told now that this is an important juncture. We're coming to an important juncture. What is there for you to do is just to continue. And what's important for me is to be here for you, And if that works in tandem, everything else will occur. This pattern, this cycle, is not only refined in terms of my working with it for 25 years or more, but it's a contemporary restatement of the classic pattern of human development. It is, in effect, the 21st century Noble Eightfold Path. And it will do its stuff. It's important for you now, though, to continue to come and to play with your work. Make your painting if you haven't done it. Bring it next week. Make your mask in the next couple of weeks and bring it by the middle of June so that we can deal with this material. Without your paintings and without your masks, your involvement here with what I do will from here on tend to be more and more ideational and more distant from the existential operation. The ticket for your existential participation is your painting and the mask of a role in your life. That mask and that painting are what you must bring to confirm your own involvement, your own existential reality in this process. It's the ticket that you pay. It's the price of admission to this drama, this dramatic action. So I encourage you to address yourself to it with courage and take it on as just a part of something that you are doing. And I will be here for you. Now we need to understand roles. And I think there's been a great deal of difficulty, I can see, for individuals here to understand, first of all, a concept of a role, and secondly, what's happening here in this situation vis-a-vis having to concern oneself with a role. And I can see that I'm somewhat deficient for the situation. I have assumed that most of you have had a digested experience with the contemporary society, but apparently this is not necessarily the case. So I want to give you some material today to take us back to reconsider something which came out in the early 1950s, in fact came out in 1950 itself, David Reisman's book, The Lonely Crowd. And Reisman, at this time, with The Lonely Crowd, devastated the intellectual scene by the poignancy of what he brought out. For instance, The Lonely Crowd had an effect in Hollywood, for instance, just to give one example out of the whole cross-section of American culture, Bud Schulberg, who was dealing with some of these themes in What Makes Sammy Run, wrote A Face in the Crowd, which I don't know if you saw the film years and years ago with Andy Griffin as the protagonist in A Face in the Crowd, Elia Kazan directing. And it was so poignant that it burnt Griffin out. He had to go to an institution for several years. I'm talking about the Andy Griffith, who was later a TV star, a family-style TV star. He had to work out of a pit of remorse because he had played a role accurately beyond his capacity to understand as a human being. And it wiped him out. Our language is the colloquial language is always very accurate. It wiped him out. It swabbed out his insides in such a way that you are squeaky clean and you know you're empty. You're not just running on empty. There's no place to put the gas. So it does no good to try to jump to maturity. Maturity has to be earned. It's the earning of it that is the preparation of the actual vehicle that will be able to resonate with the maturity And it does no good for someone to try to skip steps, to try and go to some master yogi and hope that his touch is going to bring you around. Yes, your feelings can be matured instantly by the charismatic touch, but that doesn't make the person. You can heal the body, and you can heal the body with surprising instantaneity, but you cannot make the person instantaneously. That person has to grow. It's a matter not of psychic pureness, but it's a matter of character development. It's the old saw. It takes a long time to grow up. And the most fearful thing is the last step in growing up. What is the last step? The last step is giving up your adolescence. Exiting from a comfortable ecology which you have just now mastered and just now are clever and intelligent enough to be able to make it work for you. And the temptation, is to stay there and be safe because you know all the score. You know all the ins and outs. But it's a deception. Because as soon as you have filled out a form, it begins to decay. It's the old Tao. As soon as you come to a fullness of a certain level of development, it's time to exit. It's time to make a transformational egress. It's time to go with style, to make a big ceremony about it, and that's it. The old Egyptian thing of the child having a long top knot, hanging down, getting in the way. And when you became mature, that was cut off. You don't have the handle that somebody who can punish or help you can hold you anymore. You are now without a handle. And the exiting is not only the cutting of the hair, but the accepting of the initiation into the community, into its mystic structure, into its sociological responsibility, into that personal dimension that's necessary. So we have this to make conscious to ourselves. And the next couple of months, this is exactly what we're trying to make conscious to ourselves. Just what does this amount to in our time, in our situation here? What is that process of giving up a comfortable old and going seeking for an unknown new? To put it in a dramatic way, the kind of perspective that 200 years ago would have been the essence of the romantic vision. It takes a lot of courage to step off into the unknown. But the only way to grow, once you have achieved an integration of your psychic energy, is to commit that psychic energy to the unknown. It is the only thing you can do. I remember once at the University of Wisconsin in the 1950s, a friend of mine had done excellent work in philosophy and had come to a major insight and asked at that time, her mentor said, "Well, what do you do now that you have this insight?" And he said, "My dear, you must live. This is what we must do." Now we've been taking as one of our vehicles in this art section in the development of the person. One of our vehicles is Euripides' Bacchae, because in the Bacchae, Euripides brings together the crisis moment in society and consciousness, the first time that conscious mask making was used. That is, the first time that conscious mask making was used was in Greek tragedy. In Greek tragedy in Athens, in the 5th century BC, is the identifiable threshold. It's the place where the conscious use of masks complemented the ritual use of masks. And I think you can see how the archetype has come down to us. In every theater in the world, there's usually some variation or some version of the mask of tragedy and the mask of comedy. Comedy, tragedy. Those two, to just the naive playgoer, are polarities. Oh, is this going to be a comedy tonight, or is it going to be a tragedy tonight? And for the ancient Greeks, there was just comedy and tragedy. For the Romans, there was just comedy and tragedy. I don't mean subjects, I mean the way in which the drama devolves. That polarity is esoterically a complementation. It's a complementarity. But in order to have the vision of the complementarity, one has to see the tragedy and comedy together as a whole. One's sense of the dramatic structure has to transcend the tragic or the comedic modes and see it all together. And that is extremely difficult. It is so difficult to do that it wasn't done until just 400 years ago. So it's like yesterday in human development. Just yesterday. Can you imagine we've been around in this physical form for nearly 100,000 years? And there isn't a quarter's worth of difference between us and the prototypes that have been around for several hundred thousand years. It was only just 400 years ago that consciousness matured to the point to be able to see a dramatic structure with tragedy and comedy brought together in its true fullness. And always in some individual is where the crucible for this kind of evolution happens. And the crucible for that evolutionary step was the mind and heart of Shakespeare. For he wrote not only tragedies and comedies, but he also wrote histories. Not just histories that were tragic, nor just histories that were comic, but histories that were human in the fullest, with the comedy and the tragedy together. It's in Shakespeare's histories that a new step in the evolution of human beings takes place. The fantastic giant step, but one which, like the Greek discovery of comedy and tragedy, broke the psyche of the people within which this step was taken. It's almost as if one can sense a curse upon consciousness, that when you take a conscious step, you must pay the price. And just like the Athenian society broke after the development of Greek tragedy matured to Euripides' Bacchae, the very last of the history plays of Shakespeare, the very last of the development along that line, broke the Elizabethan psyche, social psyche. In a way, the last product of the Elizabethan social psyche was the King James Bible. The King James Bible as a history, neither tragic nor comic, of man. The King James Bible is not just a translation, it is a creation. The King James Bible is an Elizabethan creation. We actually now are in a position in terms of scholarship to know that it's not very accurate. And it's a long way from being actually the case. It is an artifact of the Elizabethan culture, and as such is extremely valuable and extremely important, for it shows us very clearly the breaking point of that stage of consciousness. And as Euripides' Bacchae is the breaking point of the classical Greek psyche. The King James Bible is the breaking of the European Renaissance mind. Was there a new age? Was there glorious celebration after 1611? No. Europe fell apart. England fell apart. The monasteries were pulled down by the Cromwell soldiers. The 30 Years' War devastated Europe, left it in ruins that it didn't recover from until the time of Napoleon. One reason that Napoleon was able to be so successful is that Europe had never fully recovered. The structures that were never replaced. And in that kind of a cultural, individual vacuum, the Superman has his way without any opposition. There are no individuals able to come together in a collective way to put up any resistances. And the Superman just wipes the countryside free of all the gnats, of all the those who would get in his way. And we in our time have seen the same attempt by Nazi Germany. The next attempt will be even more difficult if we do not develop a generation of individuals to be able to withstand it. Because it's coming as sure as anybody can say. It's on the agenda. It's in preparation. And there's no way to sidestep that situation. It won't come in our lifetime, but in our grandchild generation, it'll come just as surely as you can imagine. We need now to turn that corner, to make individuals free enough to be themselves and to stand alone if they have to, but to also be able to stand together when they need to. And that's one of the overall strategies of this educational program, is to go out and do some of this yeoman labor and work to help those individuals find themselves and to encourage them when they need to work together to get the job done. And the first job, probably some 40 years or so from now, is going to be to keep this civilization from being desecrated for a very long time. Man has come out of such prisons and eventually will, but it takes a very long time. The Greek Dark Ages lasted some 500 years. The Western Christendom Dark Ages lasted 1,000 years. And who knows if the late 21st century Dark Ages come, whether it might be a whole other cycle of some 2,200 years before man would break free again. I usually don't talk to you in this way. Usually these are concerns for doctors of civilization. But you need to hear, you need to understand that the stakes are high. And if there is a firmness from time to time, it's simply shouldering and gearing up for that scale of burden. Now there's something difficult for us, and that's to understand the phenomenon of the role. And the most difficult role of all is the role of the enlightened person. In our time, the most difficult role to distinguish from yourself is that enlightened role for oneself. The biggest bait in our generation can be summed up colloquially in having some development of the third eye, the inner eye. That if I can only do that, if I can open my inner eye, my third eye, I have got it made, brother. And speaking now to try and take the edge off for you, so that you can key in your old American hackles. We have an advantage over other peoples in the sense that we have a kind of an American raspberry quality of addressing these issues when we need to. We can pull out in a hurry from our belief commitments if we have to. It makes us facile in a very shallow way, but it saves our skin in a very deep way. We have to have the capacity, like Thoreau had, of getting out of town, even though the town is comfortable and one belongs there. So long. So I want to give you some material and let you understand that there is a primordial resonance here, a parallel, a relationship between the Western Greek version of civilization and the so-called Eastern Indian version of civilization. And to let you appreciate that Greece and India are not a complementation. Greece and India are parallels, but are not complementations. The true creative tension is between the West and China, Japan. That's the creative encounter. From Ireland to India is a single conscious matrix having sibling parallel developments, but they are not antithetical to each other. And only the naive lack of experience makes Greece and India a creative tension, supposedly. It is not. It is a parallel. And to commit oneself to developing your psyche in its fullness, thinking that that's a polarity, which is going to be creative and be able to be a complementation, is a delusion. It is not the case. It never will be the case. It never has been the case. There is no creative tension between the Buddha and the Christ, to put it bluntly. The Buddha and the Christ are brothers, but they're not complementation. They're siblings on the same family tree of the same psyche. But Lao Tzu, just to put it succinctly, is extraordinarily different from the Buddha or the Christ. Extraordinarily different. In that, when there is a meeting between the Buddha and Lao Tzu, there is a tremendous creative wholeness that comes out of it, and a civilization can be born. A civilization was born. And that meeting happened somewhere around the 3rd century AD, and its place of happening was in the what is now the Gobi Desert and in a couple of seaports along the coast of southern China, what is today used to be colloquially Canton, now is Quanzhou. There has never been yet the encounter of the Greek and the Taoist, and that's what's happening in the modern West, especially in the United States. The Greek tradition and the East Asian civilizations are coming into creative encounter of each other. If you want to put it succinctly, the Gobi Desert was the anvil upon which the Buddhist-Taoist encounter happened. The Pacific Ocean in our time is the anvil on which the Taoist, Greek, Greco-Roman, Judaic, Greco-Roman West is encountering China, Japan. That is the creative encounter. The telling point, I have to use an esoteric thing, the telling point is that one of the most sophisticated consciousnesses in the contemporary West was Carl Jung. His whole technique was to achieve individuation by pulling the unconscious contents into the personality. And yet Jung, in writing, in the mid-1940s, when he was in his 70s already, said empirically, in our terms, the Chinese-Japanese do not have an unconscious. The East Asian human being, from our perspective, does not have an unconscious. It's a telling point. It's that there is not an unconscious there that could be recognized even under the idea of unconscious. It's a true creative complementation in that when you bring a form to self-consciousness, what is its full resonance? Its full resonance is the background, the space, the context in which it occurs. One becomes, as one might say colloquially, one becomes aware of one's movement. It's one thing to become conscious of your complete form as you sit in meditation or prayer. It's quite another thing to become aware of the extension totally beyond yourself, which is the space in which you occur, which is never anything, even a projected counter-self. It's truly, ancient Buddhist-Taoist interchange produced, the form, the amulet form of understanding what this was expressed in this Prajnaparamita chant. Gati gati paragati parasam gati bodhisvaha. That on achieving completeness of form in this massive complementation of the civilized extensions of oneself, there comes a moment of realization that there is also a beyond, which is completely beyond. It is, in fact, in terms, the American word that would be used as gate is gone. The Sanskrit, English have the same Indo-European language, another indication of a shared background. The Sanskrit word is gate, the American English word is gone. Gone completely. Or in the 1960s, the version when there were a few people understanding this, the phrase that came out and was used and then was abused by people who didn't know anything about what it really was, the term that came into usage about 1966, in the early part of 66, in San Francisco. That's where it first appeared, far out. Someone had become far out. And it was a term of epiphany that far out exists and that there can be a person who is far out. And so this kind of equality is there, is not only possible, but it's almost like we're under the gun now to be conscious of this. The first step is not to go to the creative encounter. The first step is to see through the false presentation of the creative encounter. Look, the old psychological form is true, style. You have to be disillusioned of your old worn out beliefs to see that they are worn out and no longer qualify as legitimate beliefs for you to have, to hold. You have to be disillusioned first. And only then in that space, that openness, are you free to have a new belief which is accurate. A new belief which is not just a doctrinal belief, but is an act of pistis, the old Greek word for faith, pistis. The existential pistis is a way of actual doing in your consciousness. It's like the bare attention in ritual in the art of person making becomes the existential realization. I believe this not as a doctrine which I hold, but because of living my life this way. So the old Rosicrucian adage which came out in the 17th century was,